and firm. Whom would you pick?
Lord Tsukiyama, Ishido, Onoshi, Toda Hiramatsu, and Sugiyama.
The Taiko's face twisted with a malicious grin.
You are the cleverest man in the empire. After me. Explain to my ladies why you'd pick those five.
Because they all hate each other, but combined, they can rule effectively and stamp out any opposition.
Even you?
No, not me, sir.
Then Torunaga looked at Ochiba and spoke directly to her.
For Yeamon to inherit power, you have to weather another 9 years. To do that, above all else, you must maintain the Taiko's peace. I pick Kiyama because he's the chief Christian daimyo, a great general, and a most loyal vassal. Next, Sugiyama, because he's the richest daimyo in the land, his family ancient. He heartily detests Christians and has the most to gain if Yeamon gets power. Onoshi, because he detests Kiyama, offsets his power, is also Christian. But a leper who grasps at life will live for 20 years and hates all the others with a monstrous violence, particularly Ishido. Ishido, because he'll be sniffing out plots. Because he's a peasant, detests hereditary samurai, and is violently opposed to Christians. Toda Hiramatsu, because he's honest, obedient, and faithful. As constant as the sun, and like the sudden best sword of a master swordsmith. He should be president of the council.
And you?
I will commit seppuku with my eldest son, Noboru. My son Sudara is married to the Lady Ochiba's sister, so he's no threat, could never be a threat. He could inherit the Kanto, if it pleases you, providing he swears perpetual allegiance to your house.
No one was surprised that Torunaga had offered to do what was obviously in the Taiko's mind. For Torunaga alone among the daimyos was the real threat. Then she had heard her husband say,
"O-chan, what is your counsel?"
"Everything that the Lord Torunaga has said, sire,"
she had answered at once,
"except that you should order my sister divorce from Sudara, who should commit seppuku. The Lord Noboru should be Lord Torunaga's heir, and should inherit the two provinces of Musashi and Shimosa, and the rest of the Kanto should go to your heir, Yeamon. I counsel this to be ordered today."
"Yodoko-sama."
To her astonishment, Yodoko had said,
"Ah, Tokichi, you know I adore you with all my heart, and the O-chan, and Yeamon as my own son. I say make Torunaga sole regent."
"What?"
"If you order him to die, I think you kill our son. Only Lord Torunaga has skill enough, prestige enough, cunning enough to inherit now. Put Yeamon into his keeping until he's of age. Order Lord Torunaga to adopt our son formally. Let Yeamon be coached by Lord Torunaga and inherit after Torunaga." "No, this must not be done,"
Ochiba had protested.
"What do you say to that, Tore-san?"
the Taiko asked.
"With humility, I must refuse, sire. I cannot accept that, and beg to be allowed to commit seppuku and go before you."
"You will be sole regent."
"I've never refused to obey you since we made our bargain. But this order, I refuse."
Ochiba remembered how she had tried to will the Taiko to let Torunaga obliterate himself, as she knew the Taiko had already decided. But the Taiko had changed his mind, and at length had accepted part of what Yodoko had advised, and made the compromise that Torunaga would be a regent and president of the regents. Torunaga had sworn eternal faith to Yeamon, but now he was still spinning the web that embroiled them all, like this crisis Mariko had precipitated.
"I know it was on his orders,"
Ochiba muttered, and now Lady Yodoko had wanted her to submit to him totally.
"Marry Torunaga? Buddha protect me from that shame, from having to welcome him and feel his weight and his spurting life. Shame? Ochiba, what is the truth?"
she asked herself.
truth is that you wanted him once? Before the Taiko, ne? Even during, ne? Many times in your secret heart, ne? The wise one was right again about pride being your enemy and about needing a man, a husband. Why not accept Ishido? He honors you and wants you, and he's going to win. He would be easy to manage, ne? No, not that uncouth bog trotter. Oh, I know the filthy rumors spread by enemies. Filthy impertinence. I swear I'd rather lie with my maids and put my faith in a harigata for another 1,000 lifetimes than abuse my lord's memory with Ishido. Be honest, Ochiba. Consider Toranaga. Don't you really hate him just because he might have seen you on that dream day?
It had been more than 6 years ago in Kyushu when she and her ladies had been out hawking with the Taiko and Toranaga. Their party was spread over a wide area, and she had been galloping after one of her falcons, separated from the others. She was in the hills in a wood, and she'd suddenly come upon this peasant gathering berries beside the lonely path. Her first weakling son had been dead almost 2 years, and there were no more stirrings in her womb, though she tried every position or trick or regimen, every superstition or potion or prayer, desperate to satisfy her lord's obsession for an heir. The meeting with the peasant had been so sudden. He gawked up at her as though she were a kami, and she at him because he was the image of the Taiko, small and monkey-like, but he had youth. Her mind had shouted that here was the gift from the god she had prayed for, and she had dismounted and taken his hand, and together they went a few paces into the wood, and she became like a bitch in heat. Everything had had a dreamlike quality to it, the frenzy and lust and coarseness, lying on the earth, and even today she could still feel his gushing liquid fire, his sweet breath, his hands clutching her marvellously. Then she had felt his full dead weight, and abruptly his breath became putrid, and everything about him vile except the wetness. So she had pushed him off. He'd wanted more, but she had hit him, and cursed him, and told him to thank the gods she did not turn him into a tree for his insolence. And the poor superstitious fool had cowered on his knees, begging her forgiveness. Of course she was a kami. Why else would such beauty squirm in the dirt for such as him? Weakly she had climbed into the saddle and walked the horse away, dazed, the man in the clearing soon lost, half wondering if all had been a dream and the peasant a real kami, praying that he was a kami, his essence God-given, that it would make another son for the glory of her lord and give him the peace that he deserved. Then, just the other side of the wood, Toranaga had been waiting for her. Had he seen her? She wondered in panic.
I was worried about you, lady, he had said.
I'm perfectly all right, thank you.
But your kimono's all torn. There's bracken down your back and in your hair.
My horse threw me. It's nothing.
Then she had challenged him to a race home to prove that nothing was wrong, and had set off like the wild wind, her back still smarting from the brambles that sweet oil soon soothed. And the same night, she had pillowed with her lord and master, and 9 months later, she had birthed Yeomon to his eternal joy. And hers.
Of course our husband is Yeomon's father, Ochiba said with complete certainty to the husk of Yotoko. He fathered both my children. The other was a dream. Why delude yourself? It was not a dream, she thought. It happened. That man was not a kami. You rutted with a peasant in the dirt to sire a son you needed as desperately as the Taiko to bind him to you. He would have taken another consort, ne? What about your firstborn? Karma,
Ochiba said, dismissing that latent agony as well.
Drink this, child,
Yodoko had said to her when she was 16, a year after she had become the Taiko's formal consort. And she had drunk the strange, warming herb char and felt so sleepy. And the next evening when she awoke again, she remembered only strange erotic dreams and bizarre colours and an eerie timelessness. Yodoko had been there when she awakened, as when she had gone to sleep, so considerate. and as worried over the harmony of their lord as she had been. 9 months later, she had birthed, the first of all the Taiko's women to do so. But the child was sickly, and that child died in infancy.
Karma, she thought.
Nothing had ever been said between herself and Yodoku about what had happened or what might have happened during that vast, deep sleep. Nothing, except forgive me a few moments ago, and there is nothing to forgive.
You're blameless, Yodoku-sama, and nothing occurred. No secret act or anything. And if there did, rest in peace, old one. Now that secret lies buried with you.
Her eyes were on the empty face, so frail and pathetic now, just as the Taiko had been so frail and pathetic at his ending. His question also never asked.
Karma that he died, she thought dispassionately. If he had lived another 10 years, I'd be Empress of China. But now I'm alone. Strange that you died before I could promise, lady, she said,
the smell of incense and the musk of death surrounding her.
I would have promised, but you died before I promised. Is that my karma too? Do I obey a request and an unspoken promise? What should I do? My son, I feel so helpless.
Then she remembered something the wise one had said.
Think like the Taiko would, or Toranaga would.
Ochiba felt new strength pour through her. She sat back in the stillness and coldly began to obey. In a sudden hush, Chimoko came out of the small gates to the garden and walked over to Blackthorn and bowed.
Anjin-san, please excuse me. My mistress wishes to see you. If you will wait a moment, I will escort you.
All right. Thank you. Blackthorn got up, still deep in his reverie and his overpowering sense of doom. The shadows were long now. Already part of the forecourt was sunless. The greys prepared to move with him. Chimoko went over to Sumiyori.
Please excuse me, Captain, but my lady asks you to please prepare everything.
Where does she want it done?
The maid pointed at the space in front of the arch.
There, sire.
Sumiyori was startled.
It's to be public? Not in private with just a few witnesses? She's doing it for all to see?
Yes.
But, well, if it's to be here, what about her second?
She believes the Lord Kiyama will honor her.
And if he doesn't?
I don't know, Captain. She hasn't told me.
Chimoko bowed and walked across to the veranda to bow again.
Kiritsubo-san, my mistress says, so sorry, she'll return shortly. Is she all right? Oh, yes,
Chimoko said proudly. Kiri and the others were composed now. When they had heard what had been said to the captain, they had been equally perturbed.
Does she know other ladies are waiting to greet her? Oh, yes, Kiritsubo-san. I was watching, and I told her. She said that she's so honored by their presence, and she will thank them in person soon. Please excuse me.
They all watched her go back to the gates and beckon Blackthorn. The greys began to follow, but Chimoko shook her head and said her mistress had not bidden them. The captain allowed Blackthorn to leave. It was like a different world beyond the garden gates, verdant and serene, the sun on the treetops, birds chattering and insects foraging, the brook falling sweetly into the lily pond. But he could not shake off his gloom. Chimoko stopped and pointed at the little Chanoyu house. He went forward alone. He slipped his feet out of his thongs and walked up the 3 steps. He had to stoop, almost to his knees, to go through the tiny screen's doorway. Then he was inside.
Thou,
she said.
Thou,
he said. She was kneeling, facing the doorway, freshly made up, lips crimson, immaculately coiffured, wearing a fresh kimono of somber blue, edged with green, with a lighter green obi and a thin green ribbon for her hair.
Thou art beautiful.
And thou?
a tentative smile.
So sorry, it was necessary for thee to watch.
It was my duty.
Not duty, she said. I did not expect or plan for so much killing.
Karma. Blackthorn pulled himself out of his trance and stopped talking Latin. You've been planning all this for a long time. Your suicide, ne?
My life's never been my own, Anjin-san. It's always belonged to my liege lord, and after him, to my master. That's our law.
It's a bad law.
Yes, and no.
She looked up from the mats.
Are we going to quarrel about things that may not be changed?
No. Please excuse me.
I love thee, she said in Latin.
Yes, I know that now. And I love thee. But death is thy aim, Mariko-san.
Thou art wrong, my darling. The life of my master is my aim, and thy life. And truly, Madonna forgive me, or bless me for it, there are times when thy life is more important.
There's no escape now, for anyone.
Be patient. The sun has not yet set.
I have no confidence in this sun, Mariko-san.
He reached out and touched her face.
Gomen nasai.
I promise thee tonight would be like the Inn of the Blossoms. Be patient. I know Ishido and Ochiba and the others.
Que va on the others, he said in Portuguese, his mood changing. You mean that you're gambling that Torunaga knows what he's doing? Ne?
Que va on thy ill humor, she replied gently. This day's too short.
Sorry. You're right again. Today's no time for ill humor.
He watched her. Her face was streaked with shadow bars cast by the sun through the bamboo slats. The shadows climbed and vanished as the sun sank behind a battlement.
What can I do to help thee? He asked.
Believe there is a tomorrow.
For a moment, he caught a glimpse of her terror. His arms went out to her, and he held her, and the waiting was no longer terrible. Footsteps approached.
Yes, Jimoko? It's time, mistress. Is everything ready? Yes, mistress. Wait for me beside the lily pond.
The footsteps went away. Mariko turned back to Blackthorn and kissed him gently.
I love thee, she said.
I love thee, he said.
She bowed to him and went through the doorway. He followed. Mariko stopped by the lily pond and undid her obi and let it fall. Jimoko helped her out of her blue kimono. Beneath it, Mariko wore the most brilliant white kimono and obi Blackthorn had ever seen. It was a formal death kimono. She untied the green ribbon from her hair and cast it aside. Then, completely in white, she walked on and did not look at Blackthorn. Beyond the garden, all the browns were drawn up in a formal three-sided square around 8 tatamis that had been laid out in the center of the main gateway. Yabu and Kiri and the rest of the ladies were seated in a line in the place of honor, facing south. In the avenue, the greys were also drawn up ceremoniously, and mingling with them were other samurai and samurai women. At a sign from Sumiyori, everyone bowed. She bowed to them. Four samurai came forward and spread a crimson coverlet over the tatamis. Mariko walked to Kiritsubo and greeted her and Sazuko and all the ladies. They returned her bow and spoke the most formal of greetings. Blackthorn waited at the gates. He watched her leave the ladies and go to the crimson square and kneel in the center, in front of the tiny white cushion. Her right hand brought out her stiletto dagger from her white obi, and she placed it on the cushion in front of her. Chimoko came forward, and kneeling too, offered her a small, pure white blanket and cord. Mariko arranged the skirts of her kimono perfectly, the maid helping her, then tied the blanket around her waist with the cord. Blackthorn knew this was to prevent her skirts being bloodied and disarranged by her death throes. Then, serene and prepared, Mariko looked up at the castle donjon. Sun still illuminated the upper story, glittering off the golden tiles. Rapidly, the flaming light was mounting the spire. Then it disappeared. She looked so tiny, sitting there motionless, a splash of white on the square of crimson. Already the avenue was dark, and servants were lighting flares. When they finished, they fled as quickly and as silently as they had arrived. She reached forward and touched the knife and straightened it. Then she gazed once more through the gateway to the far end of the avenue, but it was as still and as empty as it had ever been. She looked back at the knife.
Kashiki Yabu-sama?
Yes, Toda-sama.
It seems Lord Kiyama has declined to assist me. Please, I would be honored if you would be my second.
It is my honor,
Yabu said. He bowed and got to his feet and stood behind her, to her left. His sword sang as it slid from its scabbard.
I am ready, lady, he said.
Please wait until I have made the second cut.
Her eyes were on the knife. With her right hand, she made the sign of the cross over her breast, then leaned forward and took up the knife without trembling, and touched it to her lips, as though to taste the polished steel. Then she changed her grip, and held the knife firmly with her right hand under the left side of her throat. At that moment, flares rounded the far end of the avenue. A retinue approached. Ishido was at their head. She did not move the knife. Yabu was still a coiled spring, concentrated on the mark.
Lady, he said, do you wait, or are you continuing? I wish to be perfect for you.
Mariko forced herself back from the brink. Her hand lowered the knife. It was shaking now. As slowly, Yabu released himself. His sword hissed back into the scabbard, and he wiped his hands on his sides. Ishido stood at the gateway.
It's not sunset yet, lady. The sun's still on the horizon. Are you so keen to die?
No, Lord General. Just to obey my lord.
She held her hands together to stop their shaking. A rumble of anger went through the Browns at Ishido's arrogant rudeness, and Yabu ready to leap at him, but stopped as Ishido said loudly,
The Lady Ochiba begged the regents on behalf of the heir to make an exception in your case. We agreed to her request. Here are permits for you to leave at dawn tomorrow.
He shoved them into the hands of Sumiyori, who was nearby.
Sire?
Mariko said, without understanding, her voice threadbare.
You are free to leave at dawn.
And Kiritsubo-san? And the Lady Sazuko?
Isn't that also part of your duty? Their permits are there also.
Mariko tried to concentrate.
And her son?
Him too, lady.
Ishido's scornful laugh echoed.
And all your men?
Yabu stammered.
Everyone has safe conduct? Yes, Kashiki Yabu-san. Ishido said. Your senior officer, ne? Please go at once to my secretary. He is completing all your passes, though why honored guests would wish to leave, I don't know. It's hardly worth it for 17 days, ne?
And me, Lord General?
Old Lady Etz asked weakly, daring to test the totality of Mariko's victory, her heart racing and painful.
May I please leave also?
Of course, Lady Maida. Why should we keep anyone against her will? Are we jailers? Of course not. If the heir's welcome is so offensive that you wish to leave, then leave. Though how you intend to travel 400 li home and another 400 li here in 17 days, I don't understand.
Please excuse me. The heir's welcome isn't offensive.
Ishido interrupted icily.
If you wish to leave, apply for a permit in the normal way. It'll take a day or so, but we'll see you safely on your way.
He addressed the others.
Any ladies may apply. Any samurai. I've said before, It's stupid to leave for 17 days. It's insulting to flout the heir's welcome, the Lady Archibald's welcome, and the Regent's welcome.
His ruthless gaze went back to Mariko.
Or to pressure them with threats of seppuku, which for a lady should be done in private and not as an arrogant public spectacle. Ne? I don't seek the death of women, only enemies of the heir. But if women are openly his enemy, then I'll soon spit on their corpses too.
Ishido turned on his heel, shouted an order at the Greys, and walked off. At once, captains echoed the order, and all the Greys began to form up and move off from the gateway, except for a token few who stayed in honor of the Browns.
Lady?
Yabu said huskily, wiping his damp hands again, a bitter vomit taste in his mouth from the lack of fulfillment.
Lady, it's over now. You've won. You've won.
Yes. Yes,
she said. Her strengthless hands sought the knots of the white cord. Chimiko went forward and undid the knots and took away the white blanket, then stepped away from the crimson square. Everyone watched Mariko, waiting to see if she could walk away. Mariko was trying to grope to her feet. She failed. She tried a second time. Again she failed. Impulsively, Kiri moved to help her, but Yabu shook his head and said,
No, it's her privilege.
So Kiri sat back, hardly breathing. Blackthorn, beside the gates, was still turmoiled by his boundless joy at her reprieve, and he remembered how his own will had been stretched that night of his near seppuku, when he had had to get up as a man and walk home as a man unsupported and became samurai. And he watched her, despising the need for this courage, yet understanding it, even honoring it. He saw her hands go to the crimson again, and again she pushed, and this time Mariko forced herself upright. She wavered and almost fell, then her feet moved, and slowly she tottered across the crimson and reeled helplessly toward the main door. Blackthorn decided that she had done enough, had endured enough, had proved enough. So he came forward and caught her in his arms and lifted her up just as her mind left her. For a moment, he stood there in the arena alone, proud that he was alone and that he had decided. She lay like a broken doll in his arms. Then he carried her inside, and no one moved or barred his path. Chapter 57. The attack on the Brown stronghold began in the darkest reaches of the night, 2 or 3 hours before dawn. The first wave of 10 ninja, the infamous stealthy ones, came over the roofs of the battlements opposite, now unguarded by Greys. They threw cloth-covered grappling hooks on ropes over to the other roof, and swung across the chasm like so many spiders. They wore tight-fitting clothes of black and black tabi and black masks. Their hands and faces were also blackened. These men were lightly armed with chain knives and shuriken, small star-shaped, needle-sharp, poison-tipped throwing barbs and discs that were the size of a man's palm. On their backs were slung haversacks and short, thin poles. Ninja were mercenaries. They were artists in stealth, specialists in the disreputable, in espionage, infiltration, and sudden death. The 10 men landed noiselessly. They recoiled the grapples, and 4 of them hooked the grapples again onto a projection, and immediately swung downward to a veranda 20 feet below. Once they had reached it, as noiselessly, their comrades unhooked the grapples, dropped them down, and moved across the tiles to infiltrate another area. A tile cracked under one man's foot, and they all froze. In the forecourt, 3 stories and 60 feet below, Sumiyori stopped on his rounds and looked up. His eyes squinted into the darkness. He waited without moving, his mouth open a fraction to improve his hearing, his eyes sweeping slowly. The roof with the ninja was in shadow, the moon faint, the stars heavy in the thick, humid air. The men stayed absolutely still, even their breathing controlled and imperceptible, seemingly as inanimate as the tiles upon which they stood. Sumiyori made another circuit with his eyes and with his ears, and then another, and still not sure, he walked out into the forecourt to see more clearly. Now the four ninja on the veranda were also within his field of vision, but they were as motionless as the others, and he did not notice them either.
"Hey!" he called to the guards on the gateway, the doors tight barred now. "You see anything? Hear anything?" "No, Captain," the alert sentry said. "The roof tiles are always chattering, shifting a bit. It's the damp, or the heat, perhaps."
Sumiyori said to one of them,
"Go up there and have a look. Better still, tell the top floor guards to make a search, just in case."
The soldier hurried off. Sumiyori stared up again, then half shrugged, and reassured, continued his patrol. The other samurai went back to their posts, watching outward. On the rooftop and on the veranda, the ninja waited in their frozen positions. Not even their eyes moved. They were schooled to remain immobile for hours if need be. Just one part of their perpetual training. Then the leader motioned to them, and at once they again moved to the attack. Their grapples and ropes took them quietly to another veranda, where they could slide through the narrow windows in the granite walls. Below this top floor, all other windows, defense positions for bowmen, were so narrow that they could not be entered from outside. At another signal, the two groups entered simultaneously. Both rooms were in darkness, with 10 Browns sleeping in neat lines. They were put to death quickly and almost noiselessly, a single knife thrust in the throat for most, the raiders' trained senses taking them unerringly to their targets. And in moments, the last of the Browns was thrashing desperately, his warning shout garroted just as it had begun. Then the room secured, the doors secured, the leader took out a flint and tinder and lit a candle and carried it, cupped carefully, to the window, and signaled three times into the night. Behind him, his men were making doubly sure that every Brown was quite dead. The leader repeated the signal, then came away from the window and motioned with his hand, speaking to them in sign language with his fingers. At once, the raiders undid their haversacks and readied their attack weapons. Short, sickle-shaped, double-edged knives with a chain attached to the haft, weighted at the end of the chain, and shuriken and throwing knives. At another order, selected men unsheathed the short poles. These were telescope spears and blowpipes that sprang into full length with startling speed. And as each man completed his preparations, he knelt, settled himself facing the door, and seemingly without conscious effort, became totally motionless. Now the last man was ready. The leader blew out the candle. When the city bells toned the middle of the hour of the tiger, 4 o'clock, an hour before dawn, the second wave of ninja infiltrated. 20 slid silently out of a large, disused culvert that once had serviced the rivulets of the garden. All these men wore swords. Like so many shadows, they swarmed into position among the shrubs and bushes, became motionless and almost invisible. At the same time, another group of 20 came up from the ground by ropes and grapples to attack the battlement that overlooked the forecourt and garden. 2 Browns were on the battlements, carefully watching the empty roofs across the avenue. Then one of the Browns glanced around and saw the grapples behind them, and he began to point in alarm. His comrade opened his mouth to shout a warning when the first ninja made the embrasure, and with a whipping snap of his wrist, sent a barbed shuriken whirling into this samurai's face and mouth, hideously strangling the shout, and hurled himself forward at the other samurai. His outstretched hand, now a lethal weapon, the thumb and forefinger extended, and he stabbed for the jugular. The impact paralyzed the samurai. Another vicious blow broke his neck with a dry crack, and the ninja jumped at the first agonized samurai, who was clawing at the barbs embedded deeply in his mouth and face, the poison already working. With a final supreme effort, the dying samurai ripped out his short stabbing sword and struck. His blow sliced deep, and the ninja gasped, but this did not stop the rush, and his hand slammed into the Brown's throat, snapping the man's head back and dislocating his spine. The samurai was dead on his feet. The ninja was bleeding badly, but he made no sound and still held on to the dead Brown, lowering him carefully to the stone flags, sinking to his knees beside him. All the ninja had climbed up the ropes now and stood on the battlement. They bypassed their wounded comrade until the battlement was secured. The wounded man was still on his knees beside the dead Browns, holding his side. The leader examined the wound. Blood was spurting in a steady stream. He shook his head and spoke with his fingers, and the man nodded and dragged himself painfully to a corner, the blood leaving a wide trail. He made himself comfortable, leaning against the stone, and took out a shuriken. He scratched the back of one hand several times with the poisoned barbs, then found his stiletto, put the point at the base of his throat, and two-handed, with all his strength, he thrust upward. The leader made sure this man was dead, then went back to the fortified door that led inside. He opened it cautiously. At that moment they heard footsteps approaching, and at once melted back into ambush position. In the corridor of this, the west wing, Sumiyori was approaching with 10 Browns. He dropped two off near the battlement door, and not stopping, walked on. These two reliefs went out onto the battlement as Sumiyori turned the far corner and went down a flight of circular steps. At the bottom was another checkpoint, and the two tired samurai bowed and were replaced.
"Pick up the others and go back to your quarters. You'll be wakened at dawn," Sumiyori said. "Yes, Captain."
The two samurai walked back up the steps, glad to be off duty. Sumiyori continued on down the next corridor, replacing sentries. At length he stopped outside a door and knocked, the last two guards with him.
"Yabu-san?"
"Yes?"
The voice was sleepy.
"So sorry, it's the change of the guard."
"Ah, thank you. Please come in."
Sumiyori opened the door, but warily stayed on the threshold. Yabu was tousled, propped in the coverlets on one elbow, his other hand on his sword. When he was sure it was Sumiyori, he relaxed and yawned.
"Anything new, Captain?"
Sumiyori relaxed also and shook his head, came in and closed the door. The room was large and neat, and another bed of futons was laid and turned back invitingly. Arrow-slit windows overlooked the avenue and city, a sheer drop of 30 feet below.
"Everything's quiet. She's sleeping now. At least her maid Chimoko said she was."
He went to the low bureau where an oil lamp spluttered and poured himself cold char from a pot. Beside it was their pass, formally stamped, that Yabu had brought back from Ishido's office. Yabu yawned again and stretched luxuriously.
"The Anjin-san! He was awake the last time I checked. That was at midnight. He asked me not to check again until just before dawn. Something about his customs. I didn't understand clearly everything he said, but there's no harm. There's very tight security everywhere, eh? Kiritsubo-san and the other ladies are quiet, though she's been up, Kiritsubo-san, most of the night."
Yabu got out of bed. He wore only a loincloth.
"Doing what?"
"Just sitting at a window, staring out. Nothing to see out there. I suggested she'd better get some sleep. She thanked me politely and agreed, and stayed where she was. Women, eh?"
Yabu flexed his shoulders and elbows, and scratched vigorously to get his blood flowing. He began to dress.
"She should rest. She's got a long way to go today."
Sumiyori set the cup down.
"I think it's all a trick."
"What?"
"I don't think Ishido means it."
"We have signed permits. There they are. Every man's listed. You checked the names. How can he go back on a public commitment to us? Or to Lady Toda? Impossible, nay?"
"I don't know. Your pardon, Yabu-san, but I still think it's a trick."
Yabu knotted his sash slowly.
"What kind of trick?"
"We'll be ambushed.
Outside the castle?"
Sumiyori nodded.
"Yes, that's what I think."
"He wouldn't dare."
"He'll dare. He'll ambush us or delay us. I can't see him letting her go, or Lady Kiritsubo, or Lady Sazuko, or the babe.
Even old Lady Etz and the others."
"No, you're wrong."
Sumiyori shook his head sadly.
"I think it would have been better if she'd cut deep and you'd struck. This way nothing's resolved."
Yabu picked up his swords and stuck them in his belt.
"Yes,"
he was thinking.
"I agree with you. Nothing's resolved, and she failed in her duty. You know it, I know it, and so does Ishido. Disgraceful. If she'd cut, then we would have all lived forever. As it is now, she came back from the brink and dishonored us and dishonored herself. She got a ganain, eh? Stupid woman.
But to Sumiyori, he said,
I think you're wrong. She conquered Ishido. Lady Toda won. Ishido won't dare to ambush us. Go to sleep. I'll wake you at dawn.
Again, Sumiyori shook his head.
No, thank you, Yabu-san. I think I'll go the rounds again.
He went to a window and peered out.
Something's not right.
Everything's fine. Get some... Wait a moment. What was that? Did you hear something?
Yabu came up to Sumiyori and pretended to search the darkness, listening intently. And then, without warning, he whipped out his short sword and, with the same flashing spontaneous movement, buried the blade into Sumiyori's back, clapping his other hand over the man's mouth to stop the shriek. The captain died instantly. Yabu held him carefully at arm's length with immense strength so that none of the blood stained him, and carried the body over to the futons, arranging it in a sleeping position. Then he pulled out his sword and began to clean it, furious that Sumiyori's intuition had forced the unplanned killing.
Even so, Yabu thought, I can't have him prowling around now.
Earlier, when Yabu was returning from Ishido's office with their safe conduct pass, he had been waylaid privately by a samurai he had never seen before.
Your cooperation's invited, Yabu-san.
To what? And by whom?
By someone you made an offer to yesterday.
What offer?
In return for safe conducts for you and the engine-san, you'd see she was disarmed during the ambush on your journey. Please don't touch your sword, Yabu-san. There are four archers waiting for an invitation.
How dare you challenge me? What ambush?
He had bluffed, feeling weak at the knees, for there was no doubt now that the man was Ishido's intermediary. Yesterday afternoon he had made the secret offer through his own intermediaries, in a desperate attempt to salvage something from the wreckage Mariko had caused to his plans for the black ship and the future. At the time, he had known that it was a wild idea. It would have been difficult, if not impossible, to disarm her and stay alive, therefore fraught with danger to both sides. And when Ishido, through intermediaries, had turned it down, he was not surprised.
I know nothing of any ambush, he had blustered, wishing that Yuriko was there to help him out of the morass. Even so, you're invited to one, though not the way you planned it. Who are you? In return, you get Izu, the barbarian, and his ship, the moment the chief enemy's head is in the dust. Providing, of course, she's captured alive, and you stay in Osaka until the day, and swear allegiance. Whose head?
Yabu had said, trying to get his brain working, realizing only now that Ishido had used the request for him to fetch the safe conducts, merely as a ruse so the secret offer could be made safely and negotiated.
Is it yes or no?
The samurai asked.
Who are you, and what are you talking about?
He had held up the scroll.
Here's Lord Ishido's safe conduct. Not even the Lord General can cancel these after what's happened.
That's what many say. But so sorry, bullocks will shit gold dust before you or any are allowed to insult the Lord Yeomon. Please take your hand away from your sword.
Then watch your tongue.
Of course, so sorry.
You agree? I'm overlord of Izu now, and promised Totome and Suruga,
Yabu had said, beginning to bargain. He knew that though he was trapped, as Mariko was trapped, so equally was Ishido trapped, because the dilemma Mariko had precipitated still existed.
Yes, so you are, the samurai had said. But I'm not permitted to negotiate. Those are the terms. Is it yes or no?
Yabu finished cleaning his sword and arranged the sheet over the seemingly sleeping figure of Sumiyori. Then he toweled the sweat off his face and hands, composed his rage, blew out the candle, and opened the door. The two Browns were waiting some paces down the corridor. They bowed.
I'll wake you at dawn, Sumiyori-san,
Yabu said to the darkness. Then to one of the samurai.
You stand guard here. No one goes in. No one. Make sure the captain's not disturbed. He needs rest.
Yes, sir.
The samurai took up his new post, and Yabu strode off down the corridor with the other guard, went up a flight of steps to the main central section of this floor, and crossed it, heading for the audience room and inner apartments that were in the east wing. Soon he came to the cul-de-sac corridor of the audience room. Guards bowed and allowed him to enter. Other samurai opened the door to the corridor and complex of private quarters. He knocked at a door.
Anjin-san,
he said quietly. There was no answer. He pulled the shoji open. The room was empty, the inner shoji ajar. He frowned, then motioned to his accompanying guard to wait, and hurried across the room into the dimly lit inner corridor. Chimiko intercepted him, a knife in her hand. Her rumpled bed was in this passageway, outside one of the rooms.
Oh, so sorry, sire. I was dozing,
she said apologetically, lowering her knife. But she did not move out of his path.
I was looking for the Anjin, sire.
He and my mistress are talking, sire, with Kiritsubo-san and the Lady Achiko.
Please ask him if I could see him a moment.
Certainly, sire.
Chimiko politely motioned Yabu back into the other room, waited until he was there, and pulled the inner shoji closed. The guard in the main corridor watched inquisitively. In a moment, the shoji opened again, and Blackthorn came in. He was dressed and wore a short sword.
Good evening, Yabu-san, he said.
So sorry to disturb you, Anjin-san. I just want to see, make sure all right, understand?
Yes. Thank you.
No worry. Lady Toda, all right? Not sick?
Fine now. Very tired, but fine.
Soon dawn, eh?
Yabu nodded.
Yes. Just want to make sure all right. Understand?
Yes.
This afternoon you say plan, Yabu-san. Remember? Please, what secret plan?
No secret, Anjin-san.
Yabu said, regretting that he'd been so open at that time.
You misunderstood. Say only must have plan. Very difficult escape Osaka, eh? Must escape or...
Yabu drew a knife across his throat.
Understand?
Yes, but now have pass, eh? Now safe go out Osaka, eh?
Yes, soon leave. On boat, very good. Soon get men at Nagasaki. Understand?
Yes.
Very friendly, Yabu went away. Blackthorn closed the door after him and walked back to the inner passageway, leaving his inner door ajar. He passed Chimoko and went into the other room. Mariko was propped in futons, appearing more diminutive than ever, more delicate and more beautiful. Kiri was kneeling on a cushion. Achiko was curled up asleep to one side.
What did he want, Anjin-san?
Mariko said.
Just to see we were all right.
Mariko translated for Kiri.
Kiri says, did you ask him about the plan?
Yes, but he shrugged the question off. Perhaps he changed his mind. I don't know. Perhaps I was mistaken. But I thought this afternoon he had something planned, or was planning something.
To betray us?
Of course. But I don't know how.
Mariko smiled at him.
Perhaps you were mistaken. We're safe now.
The young girl, Achiko, mumbled in her sleep, and they glanced at her. She'd asked to stay with Mariko, as had old Lady Etsu, who was sleeping soundly in an adjoining room. The other ladies had left at sunset to go to their own homes. All had sent formal requests for permission to depart at once. With the failing light, rumors had rushed through the castle that nearly 105 would also apply tomorrow. Kiyama had sent for Achiko, his granddaughter-in-law, but she refused to leave Mariko. At once, the daimyo had disowned her and demanded possession of the child. She had given up her child. Now the girl was in the midst of a nightmare, but it passed, and she slept peacefully again.
Mariko looked at Blackthorn.
It's so wonderful to be at peace, ne?
Yes, he said. Since she had awakened and found herself alive and not dead, her spirit had clung to his. For the first hour they had been alone, she lying in his arms.
I'm so glad thou art alive, Mariko. I saw thee dead.
I thought I was. I still cannot believe Ishido gave in. Never in 20 lifetimes. Oh, how I love thy arms about me, and thy strength.
I was thinking that this afternoon, from the first moment of Yashinika's challenge, I saw nothing but death. Yours, mine, everyone's. I saw into your plan, so long in the making, nay?
Yes, since the day of the earthquake, Anjin-san. Please forgive me, but I didn't want to frighten you. I was afraid you wouldn't understand. Yes, from that day, I knew it was my karma to bring the hostages out of Osaka. Only I could do that for Lord Torunaga. And now it's done. But at what a cost, ne? Madonna, forgive me.
Then Kiri had arrived, and they'd had to sit apart, but that had not mattered to either of them. A smile or a look or word was enough. Kiri went over to the slit windows. Out to sea were flecks of light from the inshore fishing boats.
Dawn soon,
she said.
Yes, Mariko said. I'll get up now. Soon? Not yet, Mariko-sama,
Kiri told her.
Please rest. You need to gather your strength. I wish Lord Torunaga was here. Yes. Have you prepared another message about our leaving? Yes, Mariko-sama. Another pigeon will leave with the dawn. Lord Torunaga will hear of your victory today,
Kiri said.
He'll be so proud of you. I'm so glad he was right. Yes,
Kiri said.
Please forgive me for doubting you and doubting him. In my secret heart, I doubted him too. So sorry.
Kiri turned back to the window and looked out over the city.
Torunaga's wrong, she wanted to shriek. We'll never leave Osaka, however much we pretend. It's our karma to stay, his karma to lose.
In the west wing, Yabu stopped at the guardroom. The replacement sentries were ready.
I'm going to make a snap inspection.
Yes, sir.
The rest of you wait for me here. You, come with me.
He went down the main staircase, followed by a single guard. At the foot of the staircase in the main foyer were other guards, and outside was the forecourt and garden. A cursory look showed all in order. Then he came back into the fortress, and after a moment, changed direction. To his guard's surprise, he went down the steps into the servants' quarters. The servants dragged themselves out of sleep, hastily putting their heads onto the flagstones. Yabu hardly noticed them. He led the way deeper into the bowels of the fortress, down steps, along little used arched corridors, the stone sides damp now and mildewed, though well lit. There were no guards here in the cellars, for there was nothing to protect. Soon they began to climb again, nearing the outer walls. Yabu halted suddenly.
What was that?
The brown samurai stopped and listened and died. Yabu cleaned his sword and pulled the crumpled body into a dark corner, then rushed for a hardly noticed, heavily barred, small iron door set into one of the walls that Ishido's intermediary had told him about. He fought back the rusted bolts. The last one clanged free. The door swung open. A draft of cool air from outside, then a spear stabbed for his throat and stopped just in time. Yabu didn't move, almost paralyzed. Ninja stared back at him from the inky darkness beyond the door, weapons poised. Yabu held up a shaky hand and made a sign as he had been told to do.
I'm Kashigi Yabu, he said.
The black-garbed, hooded, almost invisible leader nodded, but kept the spear ready for the lunge. He motioned to Yabu. Yabu obediently backed off a pace. Then, very warily, the leader walked into the center of the corridor. He was tall and heavy-set, with wide flat eyes behind his mask. He saw the dead Brown, and with a flick of his wrist, he sent his spear flashing into the corpse, then retrieved it with the light chain attached at the end. Silently, he recoiled the chain, waiting, listening intently for any danger. At length satisfied, he motioned at the darkness. Instantly, 20 men poured out and rushed for the flight of steps, the long-forgotten back way to the floors above. These men carried assault tools. They were armed with chain knives, swords, and shuriken, and in the center of their black hoods was a red spot. The leader did not watch them go, but kept his eyes on Yabu, and began a slow finger count with his left hand. 1, 2, 3. Yabu felt many men watching him from the passage beyond the door. He could see no one. Now the red spot attackers were going up the stairs, two at a time, and at the top of this flight they stopped. A door barred their path. They waited a moment, then cautiously tried to open it. It was stuck. A man with an assault tool, a short steel bar, hooked at one end and chiseled at the other, came forward and jimmied it open. Beyond was another mildewed passage, and they hurried along it silently. At the next corner they stopped. The first man peered around, then beckoned the others into another corridor. At the far end, a sliver of light shone through a spyhole in the heavy wooden panelling that covered this secret door. He put an eye to it. He could see the breadth of the audience chamber, two Browns and two Greys, wearily on sentry duty, guarding the door to the complex of quarters. He looked around, nodded to the others. One of the men was still counting with his fingers, time to the leader's count, two floors below. All their eyes went to the count. Below in the cellar, the leader's fingers still counted in tempo, ticking off the moments, his eyes never wavering from Yabu. Yabu was watching and waiting, the smell of his own fear sweat dank in his nostrils. The fingers stopped, and the leader's fist closed up sharply. He pointed down the corridor. Yabu nodded and turned, and went back the way he had come, walking slowly. Behind him, the inexorable count began again. 1, 2, 3. Yabu knew the terrible risk he was taking, but he had had no alternative, and he cursed Mariko once more for forcing him onto Ishido's side. Part of his bargain was that he had to open this secret door.
"What's behind the door?"
he had asked suspiciously. "Friends, this is the sign, and the password is to say your name."
"Then they kill me, ne?"
"No, you're too valuable, Yabu-san. You've got to make sure the infiltration is covered." He had agreed, but he had never bargained for ninja, the hated and feared semi-legendary mercenaries who owed allegiance only to their secret, closely-knit family units, who handed down their secrets only to blood kin. How to swim vast distances underwater and scale almost smooth walls. How to make themselves invisible and stand for a day and a night without moving, and how to kill with their hands or feet, or any and all weapons, including poison, fire, and explosives. To ninja, violent death for pay was their only purpose in life. Yabu managed to keep his pace measured as he walked away from the ninja leader along the corridor, his chest still hurting from the shock that the attack force was ninja and not Ronin.
"Ishido must be mad,"
he told himself, all his senses teetering, expecting a spear or arrow or garrote any moment. Now he was almost at the corner. Then he turned it, and safe once more, he took to his heels and bounded up the stairs, three at a time. At the top, he raced down the arch corridor, then turned the corner heading toward the servants' quarters. The leader's fingers still ticked off the moments, then the count stopped. He made a more urgent sign to the darkness and rushed after Yabu. 20 ninja followed him from the darkness, and another 15 took up defensive positions at both ends of the corridor to guard this escape route that led through a maze of forgotten cellars and passages, honeycombing the castle, to one of Ishido's secret bolt holes under the moat, thence to the city. Yabu was running fast now, and he stumbled in the passageway, just managing to keep his footing, and burst through the servants' quarters, scattering pots and pans and gourds and casks.
"Ninja!"
he bellowed, which was not part of his agreement, but his own ruse to protect himself should he be betrayed.
Hysterically, the men and women scattered and took up the shout and tried to vanish under benches and tables as he raced across and out the other side, up more steps into one of the main